need you here on my mind every hour of the day. Without your sweet inspiration,
it's Tuesday night at 7 p.m. on the West Coast, which means, of course, it's time for the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. This is Tammy Jackson, and I'm welcoming you once again to an hour of sweet conservative inspiration. Like I tell you every week, if you'd like to do so, you can interact with comments and questions on Twitter during the show. Follow me at Tammy J, T-A-M-I-J. Now let's get started. My first guest tonight is Tim Constantine. Tim is the spokesperson of Rethink Ethanol. That can be found at the website rethinkethanol.com. And in case you're wondering, Rethink Ethanol is a new initiative to address our nation's failed, mandated, and subsidized corn-based ethanol policies. They're engaging voters, thought leaders, industry leaders, and policymakers in a frank conversation on the effects of corn-based ethanol. Tim Constantine, welcome to the show.
Hi, Tammy. How are you?
I am great. Now, you've been inundated with a big old storm on the East Coast. How are you doing today?
You know, I laughed. I grew up in Maine, so when I was a kid, you would see these huge blizzards. But in D.C. yesterday, there was a dusting of snow, but with the government being government, they said, no work today. So for most people in Washington, D.C., or if you were going to school, and it was literally just a little dusting and sprinkling, but I suppose better safe than sorry, perhaps.
I grew up, just a little side note here, I grew up in Bend, Oregon. That's in the center of the state. It's high desert, cold, dry, and snowy in the winter, hot and dry and gorgeous in the summer. And we'd normally have about a foot of snow on the ground. In all my years of school there in Bend, Oregon, they only canceled school once, and that's when the pipes burst at the high school, and they had to do so. Otherwise, it was tough. Put on your chains, your studded snow tires, get on cross-country skis, whatever it took, you had to be at school or on the job. So now that I live in the Portland metro area, same deal. A dusting of snow, people panic, they run out of food at the grocery store and water. It's almost laughable.
My brother sent me a little note today that showed, you know, New England being covered, and he said, oh my gosh, can you believe it? Maine is getting a snowstorm in January? Because it was silly, you know? Of course they're getting a snowstorm in January, but
oh, these are the things they have to talk about. Well, Tim, I was really unaware of the exact intent and effect of the Renewable Fuel Standard, called the RFS, until the publicist contacted me about you, about this whole issue, and then I started reading, listening to videos. There are a lot of great articles that people can find at rethinkethanol.com. Also, full disclosure, my dad is from the great state of Iowa. Dad's a scientist, and so I know all about the corn growing in Iowa and so forth, but I did not know about the effects of this renewable fuel standard. And what's interesting is, in case people are thinking this is a Democrat or Republican issue, it really should be neither, because I see people on both sides, even some greenies that are now objecting to this. And it was signed, one of the acts was signed, I believe the Energy Independence was signed by George W. Bush or the...
By Bush, that's correct.
Yes. So, Tim, tell us a little
bit. And that's probably an important place to start is... If you remember toward the middle or the end of the Bush era, how high gas prices were headed, and we also were, as we have perpetually in my lifetime and yours, had trouble in the Middle East, and so the concept here was a good one. Like so many government programs that had good intentions, it just hasn't panned out the way it was promised. But the idea was, all right, gasoline that you put in your vehicle needs an oxygenator. It needs octane. And they can make that any number of different ways. And there was a chemical they used to use that they found was environmentally dangerous to people, to the land, to everything. And so they were looking for alternatives, and they found corn is one way of doing that. Now, if you go to the gas pump now, you will most likely see a little sticker on the gas pump that says up to 10% of this gasoline is actually corn ethanol or something like that. And so the concept early on was sold as, golly, because this is up to 10%, it lessens our dependence on the Middle East. It is environmentally friendly because it's corn. And they had any number of reasons. It will be less expensive. It will be, and so there were all these reasons. And as you just mentioned a minute ago, there were some green groups that were all in for this back in 2005 and again in 2007. Sierra Club, National Wildlife, and others. They were all over this. Except what's interesting, and I think this is an important point, only because nobody ever wants to admit maybe they were wrong in Washington, D.C. Both of those groups, National Wildlife has 6 million members nationwide. Sierra Club might be the largest environmental group in the country. Both of them now want to see the renewable fuel standard repealed, or you know, the whole bailiwick changed, because it has not turned out to be green. The name itself is misleading. The renewable fuel, there's nothing renewable about it, because when you take corn and you process it to the point where it can be used as octane for your gasoline, in order to do that you have to burn more fuel than you're going to save. By the time you've made the product, you have now used up all kinds of traditional energy. You know, they were, depending on where in the country you are, that might have been coal, that might have been any number of things, in order to even make the product in the first place. So they've discovered, oh gosh, that from that standpoint it isn't green. But also, it had unintended consequences as it drove the price of corn up. With the first 40%, roughly, the first 6 billion bushels of corn grown every year is set aside for corn ethanol. And so if you have a poor growing year, if you have a drought one year and you grow more gas, grow more corn, let me start that one more time. If you have a poor growing year one year and you are a corn grower and your volume is down, that initial 6 billion bushels is still set aside for gasoline, which means there is less available for food or feed or other things, which, and this has been proven throughout its 10-year history, drives the price of everything up. Because if you eat pork, well, those pigs eat grain, eat made from corn. Or if you eat beef, it drives the price of beef up because cows eat corn as their grain. If you eat chickens, you know, if you, any of those things that you might pick up at the grocery store have become more expensive as a result of the renewable fuel standard, or anything that uses corn starch or corn chips or corn, anything with corn oil, right, which is in, you know, roughly 70% of the products in your grocery store. Everything has gotten more expensive because of they're setting aside the initial corn for gas. So why we're burning food first, and then if there's any left over, we eat it. It seems that's a silly policy.
Yes, it really is. So for people, if you're just tuning in, I'm talking with Tim Constantine. He's the spokesperson for Rethink Ethanol, and we're talking about the effects, most of which were unintended and unforeseen, of the Renewable Fuel Standard, the RFS. It was something that was, like you said, like most government programs, was well-intentioned. But the problem is, when government gets in the mix, as far as I'm concerned, they usually muck up everything. And this is no exception. The RFS, Congress created the Renewable Fuel Standard Program to reduce greenhouse emissions, expand the nation's renewable fuels sector while reducing reliance on imported oil. This program was authorized under the Energy Policy Act of 2005, expanded under the Energy Independence and Security Act of 2007. Now, Tim Constantine, in reading the renewable standard itself, I went and read the two acts, and I was at the EPA website. And full disclaimer, I am no fan of the overreaching EPA, and I am extremely grateful that it is being reduced in size under the current administration. I think that's fantastic. They have been detrimental, I believe, to our nation. But there's a caveat in that bill, and it says the statute also contains a general waiver authority that allows the administrator to waive the RFS volumes in whole or in part based on a determination that the implementation of the program is causing severe economic or environmental harm or based on inadequate domestic supply. Tim Constantine, the Manhattan Institute estimated that the government-run ethanol system cost U.S. drivers $10 billion extra a year in fuel costs. It seems to me that this is exorbitant.
It is. You pay more at the pump. You pay more at the grocery store. And what you have seen happen, some corn in the United States is subsidized by the government anyway. Forgetting RFS just for a minute, you have some government programs that you and I are paying farmers to farm. And then over and above that, you have a higher demand caused by this artificial government program. So what you've seen is more and more corn and other products that the United States has typically done, soy, for example, than the world leader in, is now Brazil is exporting soy and sending it to the United States or sending it to China, who we used to sell to. And, you know, when we talk, there's so many little far-reaching tentacles on this where we talk about the economy and impact on the economy. The most egregious are when you and I have to pay more at the pump and you and I have to pay more at the grocery store. But when all of a sudden the international, the trade deficit is off more because of this too, that's a negative. It's very hard to find a positive out of this anywhere. If you happen to be Archer Daniels Midland, you can probably find a positive out of this because you're going to make more money. But even the small farmer, your guy in Iowa, you mentioned your dad is from Iowa, my father-in-law is from Nebraska. Even the small farmer is not enthused about this program. They say, literally, we've done these focus groups and all in those states, and they'll say, Tim, if they're not having a corn program, you know what, I'm still going to farm. I will grow whatever the demand is for. That's what I do. I farm. But they don't feel beholden that corn is the magic dust here. But the way the program is set up, there are a handful of large corporate entities that make a bundle. And so, of course, they don't want to see that changed.
Yeah, there are a lot of lobbyists that are heavily invested in this. And if you really dig into it, you see that even some decent senators in the state of Iowa are beholden to these lobbies, that, and they've had huge, huge donations from, I don't know, Monsanto, all these different corporations that are big time into this ethanol scheme or boondoggle, what have you. What's interesting, Tim Constantine, is with the current administration, with what Donald Trump has done in deregulations, in downsizing, thank goodness, the EPA, and in really releasing people for energy. We talk about Keystone. We talk about the fracking in the Dakotas, about all the different pipelines that he's given the green light to that were not allowed to go forth under the Obama administration. We've got ways to obtain energy independence. We don't need a government-run program like this to help with energy independence right now.
No, and you look at fuel prices, obviously, are much lower than they were back then. You mentioned the EPA, and we've sat down in the last 4 or 5 months, we've sat down three different times with Scott Pruitt, who is President Trump's administrator of the EPA. And he's an Oklahoma guy. He understands this. He is, I would say, very much in agreement with what we're trying to achieve. The irony for us is he is being very careful. You mentioned how the Obama administration had just, the EPA had kind of picked and choose what they wanted to do. Whether the law allowed it or not, they would go ahead. And there was an overreach. And so Mr. Pruitt, Administrator Pruitt, is very, very sensitive to making sure that the law allows him to do that. We happen to believe it is. Our attorneys happen to believe it is allowed for him. And particularly, you read that one portion of the law. But he's being very cautious. And I said, on one hand, I cannot criticize that. That's the role of the EPA, is to stay within their limits. But it's our job at Rethink Ethanol to try to make sure he understands he does have the authority to do that, and then encourage him to go ahead and do that.
Yes, yes. I'm speaking with Tom Constantine, the spokesperson for Rethink Ethanol. We'll be back after this quick break. The Tammy Jackson Show is sponsored by Robart Companies. They are a true custom firearms and firearms finishing shop located in Phoenix, Arizona. They can be found online at robartguns.com. I talk to you about Robart every single week. I'm very, very proud to be associated with them, to be sponsored by them, and at times to be able to be a spokesperson for them. Robart Guns, as a true custom firearms finishing shop, can give your worn firearm new life. They have several custom firearms for those of you that want the best of the best. Also, a big note that I told you about last week, Robar will once again be at the SHOT Show that's in Las Vegas in a couple weeks, the 23rd through the 27th or so. You need to check them out. You need to check out the Polymar 15. They are the only company in the world that has a Polymar 15. That's an AR-15 with a polymer upper and lower, which brings that semi-auto rifle in at about 5 pounds, or some of them slightly less. And yet it's been proven by our military and other testers for thousands and thousands of rounds. It holds up. It's a fantastic AR rifle. You will love it. So check out robarguns.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show. This is Tammy Jackson. I am joined by my guest for this first segment, Tim Constantine. If you're just joining the show, Tim is the spokesperson of Rethink Ethanol. The website is linked on the show page. It's rethinkethanol.com. We're talking about the Renewable Fuel Standard, the RFS, and the ethanol boondoggle. Now, ethanol mandates have been a total disaster, or a pretty big disaster, for our farm economy as well as for the environment. We need to reduce the ethanol mandate and restore the habitat losses that have devastated populations of pollinators, birds, and other wildlife. Would you talk about that a little bit, Tim Constantine?
Sure. Our founder is a guy named Jerry Young from up in Michigan. Great guy. And he has a little farm, kind of a hobby farm, not a hardcore working farm, but a hobby farm up in northern Michigan. And when his kids were growing up, the monarch butterflies would migrate. They actually go from Mexico all the way up across the Midwest into Michigan. And he said he's got these pictures, I've seen them, of hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of butterflies around his children when they're little, you know, when the kids are little and everybody giggling. It's a beautiful, beautiful sight. And so he said, right, maybe 7 or 8 years ago, he noticed there seemed to be fewer of the butterflies. He just said, well, you know, they were there, but there was a thinner population. But by the last 3 or 4 years, there were none. There were literally zero of the butterflies anymore. So that's what got him started, something completely unrelated. He's not in the business. He thought, golly, why would that happen? And the very short version is, with the expansion of corn, and there's millions and millions and millions of acres in corn now that didn't used to be. And so with the expansion of corn, they use neonics and other things when they plant the corn now. So when it grows, it kills anything on contact. If a bug, a bee, anything lands on it, it keels over and dies. And so if you're a butterfly trying to travel from Mexico to Michigan, there's no place to stop that isn't impacted by the growth of this corn anymore. So it's literally, and you think, you know, okay, that's too bad. But then he started looking at, okay, what other animals, and there are pollinators out there. There are all kinds of things out there that are being impacted by this. And then he started looking. He's a businessman by trade. He's retired now. But he said, you know, golly, this doesn't make any financial sense. And the more he dug in, the more frustrated he was getting that this was just another one of those government programs that had all kinds of promises on the front end, and none of them not only are coming true, but the opposite is happening. They're being damaging to the environment, not helping the environment. They're costing people more money, not saving money. You know, they're not doing any of the things that were promised. So he's the one that got it started, but it was the butterfly. You know, the old story, when a butterfly flaps its wings, and I said it wasn't that far off in real life here, that there was no butterfly left anymore, and that was what got this whole ball rolling, is one man's passion for it.
Yes. Well, it's interesting. It was the butterfly in this case, like we talk about the canary in the coal mine. In this case, it was the butterfly that was the signal that something was amiss. I want to read something found at rethinkethanol.com. Once again, it's linked on the show page. I want everybody to go there because at the end we'll have some kind of call to action. But I want people to be reading up on this and be informed. Found at rethinkethanol.com, we read, to meet mandates set out by a 2007 law, American refineries are blending in progressively larger amounts of ethanol distilled from food crops, specifically corn. On paper, that may sound great. We're boosting domestic production of transportation fuels through agriculture, a seemingly green process. But in practice, corn-based ethanol is a policy disaster because it competes with corn's primary use, which is feeding people. It raises global food prices, starving the world's poor. Worse, it's contributing to greater monocultures in our heartlands, killing off honeybee populations and eroding soil quality. Maybe most damningly, corn biofuels have been shown to actually increase greenhouse gas emissions, destroying their, quote, green, end quote, justification. Now, it's interesting, Tim, Constantine, the ethanol production contributes to pollution because of all the nitrogen fertilizers used by farmers. So one study estimates that over half of the nitrogen pollution in the Gulf of Mexico is due to corn and soybean crops. I don't think most people know that, and I didn't really know it till I started digging.
No, and you look at the aerial or the satellite photos of that, and it's disturbing. You know, you see what's going on. There's a big, they call it a dead zone, but a big dead zone in the Gulf, or you have places in the Great Lakes. We've seen this, you know, that was a big story a year ago up in the Midwest, and we've seen it all over. And Jerry, our founder, it was interesting. He was out fishing on the Great Lakes, well, maybe 2 months ago, 3 months ago. And as the boat was going, he looked behind him, and there's maybe 2 or 3 inches of the cover of the lake is algae bloom. And so you just have, as far as the eye can see, you have this green. He took some wonderful pictures, you know, but again, it's just when you're in the midst of something firsthand, if you hear something, you think, oh, that's terrible. But then you stand there and you look at it and you think, good Lord, how did this happen? How did we do this? You know, and you do the homework, and golly, with all that extra corn, it's causing a lot of trouble. So let me throw one other item out there at you, too, that's completely separate. It's an interesting group of people that have gotten together to fight this, because the refiners, the oil refiners, don't particularly like it for a variety of reasons. The environmental community doesn't like it for the reasons you've outlined really well. The economists don't like it because it drives up the price of feed and cattle and chickens and virtually everything in the grocery store. But there's another group out there, and that's your small engine people. If you have a motorcycle, or you have a snowmobile, or you have a lawnmower, or you have anything that has a small engine, when they use corn ethanol, it damages your small engine. None of those were designed for something that didn't have primarily real gasoline going in. Some gas pumps will have, you know, an extra 50 cents a gallon, just plain old gasoline now, for people that are taking their boat out or for people that are trying to mow their lawns. But there's a whole segment, I mean, I assume most people mow their lawn or have somebody that does if they don't do it themselves. But, you know, it's something that, again, impacts everybody. The equipment life of any small engine, it just is shortened dramatically because of this one crazy law.
It's so funny because it, as we mentioned a number of times, it was something that they had good intentions, but as it plays out, it's not doing any good. It's ridiculous. You know, what's funny is we were talking about all this corn and the corn and soybean crops and the millions of acres of corn that weren't there before and the harm that it's doing. I had this thing, a funny thought flashed through my mind. This happens frequently. I don't know if you've seen the movie Secondhand Lions with Robert Duvall and Michael Caine. It's a hilarious show, great for the whole family. But there's a scene in there where they're two old bachelor uncles that have a great nephew come live with them for the summer, and he gets them involved in some other enterprises such as farming. They buy all these seeds and they plant them, and they thought they had all these different things, watermelon, different vegetables, etc. Except when it grows up, it all looks like corn, and they found out they've been hoodwinked to just plant a bunch of corn. So I would encourage people to see that movie. It's a good movie for the whole family, and when they see the corn scene, they'll know what I mean, and it will further emphasize what we're talking about here. This is a big-time boondoggle. And so now the question is, Tim Constantine, people can go to rethinkethanol.com. They can read all about it. But what can we do? What is the call to action here for consumers? So in the minute or so that's remaining, give us some good practical measures.
Well, you mentioned at the beginning it's not a partisan item. This isn't Republican or Democrats. What it is you have a handful of senators and congressmen from those Midwest states that represent the Archer Daniels Midland and those type companies that don't want to see this go. Everybody else is pretty much in agreement. So we have been working both on the House side and on the Senate side to try to get some action. And what you're going to see early in February, House Energy and Commerce has a subcommittee on the environment, and they're going to hold a hearing on this very thing. And I expect a bill to come out of that. And I've talked with the speaker about it, and we expect to have probably in excess of 100 co-sponsors for the bill to repeal or dramatically change the RFS. And I think we can get it passed there. On the Senate side, Senator Ted Cruz is working with us with a whole number of John Cornyn and others with a whole group, and has brought this to the attention of the White House and the EPA and has really put it on the front burner as well. I just met with Senator Cruz a couple of days ago on this item. So we think in the coming weeks we'll see some action, and we just want people, A, to know it's not front page news maybe the way a tax cut is. So we wanted people to be aware and that it can benefit you. You can save money at the grocery store, at the gas pump, or elsewhere if they will repeal this.
Yeah, oh, it sounds fantastic. Tim Constantine, it has been great to make your acquaintance. I appreciate you sounding the alarm for Rethink Ethanol. I'll be encouraging many, many people to go to the website and to get involved in this. I'd love to have you back on the show in the future, and hopefully once the renewable fuel standard is either dramatically lessened or perhaps sunsetted.
You bet. Well, hopefully we will have a end time definite for it. Tammy, thank you so much.
Oh, you bet. It was been great having you on. You're listening to the Tammy Jackson Show on the 405. I'll be back on the other side of the break with my guest, Gary Byrne. The Tammy Jackson Show is brought to you by Rent-A-Computer. An agent from rentacomputer.com can save your company time and money on your next short-term need for a computer, audiovisual, or office equipment rental. They deliver the rental hardware your event needs anywhere to your office, trade show booth, or event venue location in the United States or Canada. Their offerings include Apple iPads, iPhones, Microsoft Surface tablets, and copiers. So, if you're planning your next corporate event, remember, rentacomputer.com provides a superior turnkey event rental service with one point of contact for clients both large and small. Visit rentacomputer.com or call them at 800-736-8772. That's rentacomputer.com, sponsor of the Tammy Jackson Show.
You're on the 405.
Shop Amazon, support the 405 Media. Click on the banner on top of our homepage. Then you know what to do. The 405 Media is an Amazon associate. That means you get great deals on Amazon.com and support the talk alternative at no extra charge. We are the 405media.com. Thank you.
This is Mike from the Wrestling Mayhem Show, the show where we get fans and people in the wrestling industry together to talk about pro wrestling, WWE, NXT, WrestleMania, all kinds of fun. It's a podcast party. Check it out. Wrestling Mayhem Show right here on the 405 Media.
Listen to the Wrestling Mayhem Show now 7 nights a week, 9 p.m. Pacific, midnight Eastern, right here on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
Let's talk tech. Tech news discussions from the people in the industry right here in Pittsburgh. Online, gadgets, startups, and more. Check it out at awesomecast.net.
AwesomeCast. It's all about tech and it's all about gadgets. It's AwesomeCast, Monday through Friday, 9 a.m. Pacific, noon Eastern, on the 405media.com.
You're on the 405.
I love Tammy.
I love you back, Kurt, because I'm a caring kind of gal.
The Tammy Jackson Show.
I'm just one conservative gal encouraging you to keep fighting the good fight.
Tammy is what conservative insurgency is about.
Tammy Jackson, the granddaughter of legal immigrants.
In Honduras, they had 60,000 murders per 100,000, or something like that. And I thought, whoa, that is a lot.
Like every other person on the block is dead.
Tammy Jackson, the emerging threat from the West Coast.
Tammy has made herself into a rising radio star.
When we have these mass amounts just suddenly pour into the United States, we have a worse problem than we already have had with assimilation.
The Tammy Jackson Show, Tuesday nights, 10 Eastern, 7 Pacific, only on the 405media.com.
Anything for you, Tammy.
405.
The President and I have witnessed firsthand the compassion and commitment of Americans as friends, neighbors, and strangers continue to volunteer time and money to help one another following the recent hurricanes. Your help is still needed. Donate to an organization of your choice and volunteer to help your fellow Americans. Visit nvoad.org and ready.gov. to learn more.
Welcome back. This is Tammy Jackson. I'm a little over halfway through my show tonight, and now I'm joined by my guest, Gary Byrne. Gary's been on the show before, but just in case, let me tell you a little about him. Gary Byrne served in federal law enforcement for nearly 30 years in the U.S. Air Force Security Police, the Uniform Division of the Secret Service, and most recently as a federal air marshal. While serving as a Secret Service officer, Gary protected President Bill Clinton and the First Family in the White House. Gary Byrne was on the show about a year and a half ago, and we were talking about his book, The Hatchet Book Group Bombshell, Crisis of Character, a White House Secret Service officer discloses his firsthand experience with Hillary, Bill, and how they operate. Now, Gary's got a brand new book. I've got it linked on the show page. You've got to get a copy of this. It's titled Secrets of the Secret Service, The History and Uncertain Future of the U.S. Secret Service. Gary Byrne, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much. I'm glad to be here.
Well, I want to recap some things that we covered a year and a half ago. Just in case everybody didn't hear that, you've got some really interesting background, which I like to get people's background so that everybody knows your worldview, where you're coming from, et cetera. I think it's great. Your father played a big role in your previous book and in your life. He was an Air Force mechanic in Japan during the Korean War, and you later joined the Air Force. You have some funny lines in that first book. Because you were in basic training, you were extremely lonely, and your dad's advice was to shape up. He said, Gary, you wanted this. I told you it'd be like this. You write that he was right. You needed to take his advice and rub some dirt on it. I thought that was hysterical.
Yeah. He was pretty good with the little quips and the one-liners. And he was very instrumental in my upbringing, obviously, but not just because he raised me, but because of the way he raised me. He was just, my dad was all about his country, his family, and God. And that's the way we were all raised. So that's pretty much kind of how I got here.
Yeah, well, and that's terrific. I mean, a lot of the special agents I know, a lot of the SEALs, they're famous for saying, for God and country. And
right.
that's That's what I think of when I think of your dad and your upbringing. So you had a really good respect for our country, for our flag, for law enforcement, for the military, and that informed you as you were growing up, and it's informed you as you've written these books, disclosing things that you really feel need to be disclosed. And I, for one, am very grateful that you've written both of these books.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that.
You know, you did that stint in the Air Force, then you entered the Secret Service. You started at the White House in July of 91. You were part of the Secret Service Uniform Division, also called the SSUD. Would you explain to everybody the difference between SSUD and a special agent?
Sure. The special agents are usually college-educated. Or they are college-educated, usually, and then they get into the Secret Service. They are also trained as investigators. They investigate counterfeit credit card and telephone fraud, and of course, their primary purpose is protection of the president of the United States, the vice president, their families. The agents are the people you see in suits around the immediately around the president, the protectee. And then the uniform division kind of does almost everything else to a certain extent. There's also different parts of the Secret Service, the technical services division. These are the smart people that find and develop body armor that we use for ourselves and for the president, and types of light metal and armor that protect the president and his family. But the uniform divisions, primary responsibility is the physical protection of the White House. They're the outer perimeter. They're the middle perimeter of the White House, the post inside the White House, inside the West Wing, the East Wing, at the bottom of the private living quarters of the White House. The Secret Service Uniform Division does the metal detectors, the canine bomb sniffing dogs, the counter sniper teams, the emergency response teams at the White House and at the Vice President's residence. And then they uniform division officers travel all over the world doing the metal detectors for the president and the vice president and their families.
Okay, there are so many, and we'll talk about this later this evening about the concentric circles of protection.
Right.
And there are a lot of them, and they're very, very important. You write about the Secret Service training that you were to appear imposing and not to be too chummy with the protectees. I thought that was pretty interesting because, as in your first book, and some of this is recapped in the latest book, especially in chapter one, but you talk about the relationship with the Clintons. The Clintons were very adversarial to their protection detail, they didn't want you guys to be imposing.
No, you know what? Especially Mrs. Clinton. Here's the thing. Everybody likes the ideal of being the president of the United States or being, you know, the spouse, the first lady of the president of the United States, until you realize what you really signed up for. And when you get elected, not until you get elected do you realize that the Secret Service is going to be part of your life for a very long time, possibly for the rest of your life, depending on how good the Secret Service does their job. But Mrs. Clinton was unusually hostile towards us, as I talk about in my first book, Crisis of Character, and I reiterate it, like you said, in my second book, Secrets of the Secret Service. She didn't like us. She clearly didn't like the military. And, you know, she wasn't, listen, 100% of the time she wasn't arrogant and rude to us, but most of the time she was, a lot of times. And, you know, I talk about those stories where she had a difference of opinion where she wanted to do something with some visitors in the Oval Office. The president was not there. She wanted to leave her staff member there to escort them. She couldn't do it. And then she berated me. You know, she called me nasty names, you know, called me an a-hole and said the uniform division was a bunch of a-holes, and then threatened to have us all fired. And then reiterated that they should have fired us all when they first got there. And that's the way she was. She was like a child, a child dictator, really. And and we really... The country really dodged a bullet when she lost to President Trump.
Yeah. Oh, tell me about it. When we got down to it was a bilateral. We could only have Hillary Clinton or Donald Trump. He was not my first choice, but boy, was he my choice at the end, because no way did I want Hillary Clinton. I knew a whole lot about her before I read Crisis of Character. And after reading Crisis of Character, all my bad feelings and suspicions were confirmed. And one of the things people need to know that you and I talked about last time, Gary Byrne, concerning some things that you wrote about in Crisis of Character, I picked up on the fact that they did not want security detail, the Secret Service agents, to be imposing, to look luminous and imposing, which is one of the first layers of protection, I believe, with any kind of law enforcement or military. And that really, Gary, explains things like what happened in Mogadishu, as well as Benghazi, I believe.
Yeah. The whole thing with the Secret Service, like you just mentioned earlier, it's interlocking rings of concentric security. It's the agents that are very close to the protectee, and then maybe another ring of agents or uniform division officers. And these interlocking rings of security are doing everything at one time. They're looking for the person that stands out. They're looking for somebody with a gun. And then outside of those two or three rings, then you have the counter sniper guys that are, if you're outside, that are up on roofs with powerful binoculars and high powered rifles looking for the sniper. The first thing, your first line of security and your second line of security that are on the ground there, the protectee, do need to look imposing. You know, we don't have the Secret Service agents and officers aren't rude. We don't walk around kicking people and screaming at them, but we do need to be imposing, because it's very important, their job that we have to do. You just can't run up to a protectee, and this is one of the reasons I wrote some of the things I wrote in Crisis of Character, and one of the reasons I wrote Secrets of the Secret Service, because the Secret Service, the way it was corrupted, not just during the Clinton years, but primarily during the Clinton years, they broke down those security barriers. The first thing the Clintons tried to do when they got into the White House is break down the security screening system that the FBI and the Secret Service had set up to hire people to work inside the White House. And they started breaking that down because the people they wanted to hire were not of great character. And they started breaking the Secret Service down that way. And many years later, there's many examples that I talk about in my book, Secrets of the Secret Service, that show you that they're not responsible for all the problems in the Secret Service, but they're responsible for quite a bit of it.
Yes, yes. And the book that we're talking about now, the one that has just come out that's phenomenal, I've got a copy of it in my hand right here. It's titled Secrets of the Secret Service, The History and the Uncertain Future of the U.S. Secret Service. It's linked on the show page. As soon as the show is over, I am imploring everybody to get copies of this, because you not only build the case for why the Secret Service is broken, you give great suggestions for how to fix it, make it great again. The first chapter of Secrets of the Secret Service is titled Clinton Characters, which is why I wanted to reprise some of what we talked about last time from Crisis of Character. But in that first chapter, Clinton Characters, you begin the chapter. It should come as no surprise that President William Jefferson Clinton and First Lady, I think you use that term lightly. Hillary Rodham Clinton's time in the White House had a pivotal and irreversibly negative impact on the Secret Service. This has nothing to do with their politics. It's an obvious fact. Now, Gary Byrne, in this book, Secrets of the Secret Service, you go on to explain how the Clintons, beginning with their campaign, scheduled events that were kind of more like rock concerts. They were large. The schedule changed constantly and rapidly. And you write on page 26, the Clinton campaign felt there was no point in security if it was going to compromise the goal of the event. The Secret Service, on the other hand, felt there was no point in doing an event if the protected was going to get killed. The staff considered the Secret Service to be a hindrance and burden as opposed to a partner in protection. That's a dangerous scenario, Gary Byrne.
Yes, it is. Yes, it is. And you know, the Clintons are not the first time the Secret Service has run into this, but it was incredibly pronounced with them. And what I mean by that is, the first time anybody in the Secret Service ever heard, and I talk about it later on in the book, where during a Clinton event, where the staff pressured the Secret Service agent that was in charge of the event so hard, pressured them so much that they wanted us to shut the metal detectors off so that we could let people in faster, so they could say that they got more people into the arena than anybody else, and to make the president look more popular. And I refused to do it. I refused to shut the metal detector off. I said, if you want to shut off, do it yourself. And I asked the agent, I said, give me a name. He said, what do you mean? I said, give me the name of the person that's ordering you to shut off this metal detector. And he said, he didn't know what to say because he didn't want to give anybody up. So, you know, when that story came out, people said, oh, you know, some higher-ups of the Secret Service said, oh, you know, we never shut the metal detectors off. It's not true. They did do it. And it actually happened again during President Barack Obama's, or excuse me, President George W. Bush's time, where they got overrun setting up the metal detectors, and they had to shut them off.
Wow.
So the Clintons were tough to protect. You know, every administration has its problems, but these guys were unbelievable. And nobody in the history of the Secret Service, to my knowledge, even as bad as a reputation that sometimes President Jimmy Carter had with the Secret Service and Lyndon Baines Johnson, nobody berated the Secret Service and the staff like Hillary Clinton did. It was unbelievable.
Oh, yeah. I've read that in other books. There was another book written by a Secret Service agent, and he talked about her language, which was pretty blue. And I think it's heinous that somebody that is a protectee would be berating the Secret Service detail that are trained and willing to take a bullet for that person. It's awful. It's beyond reprehensible. In this new book, which is fantastic, titled Secrets of the Secret Service, The History and Uncertain Future of the U.S. Secret Service, you talk about a number of things that I had no clue. For instance, in 2015, there was a $2.8 billion budget for the Secret Service, but nobody was accountable for it. Has that
right.
changed at all since 2015, Gary Byrne?
Well, here's what I know about that. I don't know if it's changed, but it's typical of the Secret Service. This is the problem they're facing right now. They have a new director who is not a former Secret Service agent, which is great. That's what they've needed for years, to break that arrogant mentality. Now, don't get me wrong. The working men, the working rank-and-file men and women of the Secret Service do a good job. But when they move up and they get to these executive positions, they kind of lose their mind. And it becomes all about them, so to speak. And they try to grow this. They grew this agency so fast in the mid to late 90s that they don't know how to manage themselves. They had to admit, the director at the time was Joe Clancy. He had to admit to Congress in 2015 with a budget over $2 billion that they didn't have an account, and they didn't even have an accounting system. They didn't understand what parts of the government their money came from and where it was going to. Now, how is that acceptable? You know, that's taxpayer dollars. Listen, nobody in this country wants them not to have the assets, the money they need, but you can't be wasting it and can't tell you can't admit to Congress what you're doing with it and how you're spending it. I'm sorry, things have to change and change drastically. But in typical Secret Service fashion, one particular congressman, his name was Chaffetz, who's left Congress now, but
yes.
Congressman Chaffetz was holding the Secret Service responsible for their action. And he was going after them, asking questions, trying to get the details. And in true Secret Service fashion, executive fashion, here's what they did. They discovered when they didn't like what Chaffetz was doing and asking these hard questions and holding them accountable, they discovered that about 10 or 12 years before that he had applied to the Secret Service, and he wasn't accepted, which is very common. A lot of people don't get accepted in the Secret Service. But that means they had a file on him. So they went and looked into his file, and they found some things that might be derogatory towards him if it got leaked out. There were 40 supervisors and managers inside the Secret Service. They had this email on their on their computers talking and joking about outing this information to a friendly reporter to basically politically assassinate this congressman. I'm sorry, they have lost their way.
Wow.
And this is just this is one very good example of how the Secret Service has lost its soul.
Yes, and I absolutely like that congressperson you're talking about.
Yes.
Something else you pointed out, that the average special agent tasked with protecting the president received a measly 42 hours of training a year. How is that even acceptable, Gary Byrne?
It's not acceptable. What they end up doing is they ignore all the rules and regulations because, again, these people that have been managing this agency, the mentality they've been using all these years is they keep treating their employees terribly. They leave. They retire, and then it's hard for them to hire new employees because the job is tough. And two, their hiring process, they never keep it going. For instance, one of the other things that Congressman Chaffetz pointed out was that they had given the Secret Service millions of dollars, millions and millions of dollars, 2 years before or 3 years before to hire many, many agents and officers, and they did for 2 years, but they stopped doing it. But they were still getting the money. And the congressman said, where's the money? And they just looked at him like, we don't know.
Oh, my word. Folks, if you're just joining the show, I'm having a great conversation with Gary J. Byrne. He served in federal law enforcement for over 30 years. He was a part of the Uniform Division of the Secret Service. He protected President Bill Clinton and the First Family in the White House. And we're talking in particular about Gary's revealing new book, Secrets of the Secret Service, The History and Uncertain Future of the U.S. Secret Service. We've just got a few minutes left. I knew the time would go really, really fast, but I want to tell people in the book, Gary not only talks about current day problems with the Secret Service, you trace the history of protective detail from President Washington, first General Washington, then President Washington, to the Madisons, during the time when the White House was burned and looted by British troops. And you go through a number of different presidents. You talk about the Kennedy assassination, where you write that it was extremely simple. The Secret Service did everything wrong. The assassin or assassins did everything right. Great, great history in this book, and it's very interesting to read about the Kennedy motorcade. There was zero protection for Kennedy, Gary Byrne, and that motorcade was going slower than somebody in their van picking up their kids in a school zone.
Right. You're exactly right. And what you just mentioned, the speed they were going, all the mistakes that were made with the motorcade route, and the fact that a lot of the agents the night before had been out to 3 to 5 o'clock in the morning having a good time drinking. So, and many witnesses came forward later on, agents and stuff who felt guilty because the Secret Service tried to hide a lot of that information from the Warren Commission and from other investigations. And, you know, some of these guys were possibly still intoxicated. Most of them, not all of them, but most of them were hungover. The two people that you can tell that weren't, that were ready to do their job when the first shot rang out, was Clint Hill, who is the man you see in the Zapruder film running from the car behind President Kennedy's car to President Kennedy's car. That's Clint Hill. That guy did what he was supposed to do. The other man that you don't see in the video is Rufus Youngblood, who was Vice President Johnson's lead agent. He was in the right front seat of President Johnson's car. This guy was switched on. When he heard the first shot, he stood up in the seat of the car, turned around, dove over the bar in the back of the open car, like the roll bar,
right,
and then jumped on top of the vice president and his wife, pushed them down on the floor, and covered them with his own body. Those are the two people that did the right thing. The next thing that was happening as those shots were going off, and as these guys were doing the right thing, the driver of the car, who was not a normal driver, who hadn't been trained to be a driver, made some mistakes. And one of the mistakes he made, besides going so slow, was he put his foot on the brake twice. He basically slowed the car down even more and made it easier for Oswald to get that shot off. And that's what leads, this kind of incompetence and mistakes and poor training is what leads to all these conspiracy theories about the Kennedy assassination.
Wow. Wow. Oh, my goodness. We're running out of time. We're talking about Gary Burns' revealing new book, Secrets of the Secret Service, The History and Uncertain Future of the U.S. Secret Service. He's got some great history in there. You'll want to read about Kennedy, Lincoln, etc., up through the present day. And then in Chapter 9, Making the Secret Service Great Again, you outline major problems with the Secret Service and then give recommendations for restructuring. Gary Byrne, you closed Crisis of Character with this. The bottom line, my job in the 90s was to lay down my life for the presidency. My obligation today is to raise my voice to help safeguard the presidency from Bill and Hillary Clinton, to remind readers like you of what happened back then. You close Secrets of the Secret Service with a dire warning, and you write, all the while the renowned and beloved Secret Service slowly collapses and rots from the inside out in front of the world, and another president will die. The tragedy of assassination will come to our modern era. So you write this book hoping to thwart future assassinations and problems and to better the Secret Service once again.
Yes, that's exactly is my motivation. You know, again, like I told you when I wrote the first book, and my goal was to get the truth out about Hillary Clinton. And because if she had gotten elected, my fear was, you know, how can I look my kids in the face? And the same thing now. If I don't come out and if I didn't write this book and tell the truth, and the truth is, when we first started writing Secrets of the Secret Service, it was actually a book about regicide, which is the word for slaying a king. It was about assassination. But as we started developing the book, I turned to my co-writer, who I couldn't have done this without, Grant Schmidt, and I said, Grant, you know, we're missing the story. And he said, you're exactly right. The story is that it's not that they have problems and they might fail. They've already failed, and nobody's looking at it from that perspective. And,
wow.
And that's why I wrote Secrets of the Secret Service.
It's a fantastic book. Gary Byrne, thank you for taking the time to be on the show tonight. Thank you for writing this important book, Revealing the Crisis of Character Within the U.S. Secret Service. I hope hundreds of thousands read this book, and most importantly, that those who can impose needed changes read the book and save lives. And I think in the vein of Charles Schulz and his beloved Charlie Brown, I have to say you're a good man, Gary Byrne.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
I will. Take care. Hey, thanks for listening. The Tammy Jackson Show on the 405 will be back next week with more great guests. Until then, this is Tammy Jackson reminding you to wake up. Don't be silent. Let your voice be heard, because we have a country to save.
I cut my teeth on the back of an old church pew. I learned to walk in the ways of light and truth. And I was told not to speak till I was spoken to. I heard it preach what I should and I should not do. And the choir sang, ooh. I tried to be a good boy, but I ain't a boy no more. I've seen some things that a man just can't ignore. And this world's gonna see what I'm standing for. I've kept my peace, but I can't hold my tongue anymore.